Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today's guest is Osi Adelfang. Osi is an Israeli-American author. Osi is also the editor of the groundbreaking new anthology, Shifting Sands. Osi, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for doing the show. It's a very important collection of essays you have in Shifting Sands, and I didn't tell my audience yet, but I wrote the introduction, or I don't know if it was the intro or the foreword to it, and I was very honored to write that. So, Osi, please tell my audience, our listeners, about Shifting Sands.
Well, I want you to know that we were so honored that you wrote the book's introduction, and I believe they ended up calling it, they called it the foreword. So thank you for writing the foreword, and I think that something that you wrote as I was looking through it sums the point of the book up really well and very simply. Let me say that the essays comprise a wide sector of Jewish women with ages ranging from the 20s to the 80s, different life experiences and different individual perspectives. But the one common thread, as you wrote, is that, and I'm quoting you, through these histories and testimonials, we are taken to a human world where transformation comes early or late, but it always comes. And you wrote that you were proud to write this introduction, and I agree as the editor. I'm very proud to have been entrusted with these beautiful stories. And I think transformation is a great place to start talking about the book and what it's about and what it means.
Yes.
So I'm a Jewish Israeli, and I had my own transformation on the topic of Israel-Palestine, and that transformation was what inspired my own essay and then inspired me to collect the other essays and have the book. And it's my hope that the stories, in the way that they filled my heart and yours, that more people will have their own transformations on the topic, will open their hearts and break down first their own walls and then the literal wall separating the Israelis and Palestinians. And I really feel that the possibility of transformation is what gives me hope in this situation, because there's not a lot of other places to look for that.
Well, and it is a book of written by, the essays are written by Jewish women, and they're all supportive of Palestinian rights, or, maybe you can say it better, what I'm trying to say.
The questioning, I guess, that comes when you're Jewish and you've been raised in a certain way with certain beliefs and with certain facts presented, or with certain items presented as facts that are sort of just like the air you breathe. You're so sure that this is how things are, that's how things have always been presented. When I began to question these things, I felt very alone, and that's how this book project started. And so I believe that all these stories, through these different women's voices, sort of some head-on and some in more circular ways, describe that transformation and where you have to go as a Jewish person to coming to a place of empathy and a place of peacefulness in terms of the realities of Israel and Palestine. For me, these different stories, so much of them themselves were part of my transformation. I started the book, and I can talk about that if you like, and wrote my own essay, but I still had very limited information, and I still believed so much of what I'd been taught as a Jewish girl.
What are some of the things you were taught? As a Jewish girl.
That I was taught. Well, I think that the biggest misconception for me personally, I can only speak for myself, but I think for other Jewish people, is that we came to a sparsely populated land. We heard the phrase, a land without a people for a people without a land. And so there was this sparsely populated desert that we came to, and the reason that there was conflict in that area was because Arab anti-Semitism caused it and fueled it and continues to fuel it. And that is the history that Israeli kids are taught, and my Jewish American upbringing confirmed that and continued to reinforce that that was the reality. And in writing the book, it was a very difficult thing to face that all this stuff was based on a mythology, basically, that's not only wrong, but that when you look at history, and I'm talking about, you know, Israeli historians and Israeli sources, we now know was purposely, from the beginning, from the late 1800s, created this propaganda of a land without a people, for a people without a land, and was purposely created as propaganda by the early Zionists and has continued on, and that we, it was a very painful thing for me to learn that I had based my cultural pride on basically lies that were deliberately created to instill these very feelings that I had. And I felt like an idiot, and I felt a lot of grief for this part, this sense of self, this pride in my people that was basically based on an invented story.
Right.
So I would say that, I understand where Jewish people are coming from in their difficulties with this issue, because even for me, who's not that connected to the Jewish community here, admitting that your entire understanding of an issue that you've deeply believed and it was wound into my sense of self that it's wrong is very difficult to do. But I think that at some point you have to face the truth, and that facing the truth doesn't take away your Jewish identity or your place in the world, that in the long run, moving toward the truth and then taking action for justice is an amazing and joyful transformation. And I hope that this book helps people move through those emotions along with the women who wrote the stories and bring them, first of all, the feeling that they're not alone in their questioning, and then ideas about how to move forward.
Well, tell us about some of the women. I read all the essays before I wrote my introduction, and there were some of the stories that particularly moved me. But tell us about some of the women in the book and some of the authors that wrote some of these essays.
Well, one of the authors that has recently been in the alternative press a lot, because the mainstream press does not cover this issue from the perspective of the Palestinians so much as to just not mention the entire, Gaza Freedom March that went on this fall, and
right.
all the thousands of people and all the supplies that were trying to get through Egypt, and nothing, very tiny bits of information, but basically nothing. Most people don't even know that it happened. And
right.
one of the participants is got a lot of press because of her very interesting story that she details in the book, is a woman named Hetty Epstein.
Right.
She's the one that you were referring to, who's a Holocaust survivor, and she was on the Gaza Freedom March, and she's in fact planning, and she went on a hunger strike, and she was interviewed, she said, like 164 times in 30 days. So people have heard of her a little bit who are paying attention to this, because again, it was not in the mainstream press, but Hetty is planning to, there's going to be another boat convoy going to Gaza in May, and she is planning to be on it. And in fact, this woman is so amazing that in her 70s, when she first began with the Free Gaza movement, she learned how to swim for the first time in her life so that she would be allowed to go on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So here she is. She's now an 86-year-old woman. She's a Holocaust survivor. She lived in the U.S. Since 1949. She had been one of the kinder transport children who escaped Nazi Germany and went to live in London, and both of her parents were murdered at Auschwitz. And she went back to Germany, and then she worked on the Nuremberg trials, and then she came to the United States in 1949. And for me, one thing that I could relate to, and that I think other Jewish people that are not that connected to this issue can relate to, even though it was a different time, I'm a different generation than her, how it's possible to live in the United States and be Jewish and have this sort of vaguely happy idea that it was good that Jews had a homeland, also kind of vaguely know that unfortunately the Palestinians were in a bad situation because of it, but not really becoming very engaged in the topic and just continue your life here. And so she became an anti-war activist on the Vietnam War. And here I'd like to, if it's okay, read a short excerpt from her piece where she talks about her transformative moment.
Yes.
In her own words. This is from her piece, Do Not Stand Idly By. I was aware of the 1967 and 1973 Israeli wars, but other than being opposed to war, was not involved. It was not until 1982 that Israel-Palestine returned to the forefront of my mind. I heard about the Sabra and Shatila massacre in a meeting of a mainstream Jewish community group. This massacre of Palestinian and Lebanese refugees was committed by Christian militia, but the camps were surrounded and controlled by the Israeli military that let the militia in. The community group's reaction shocked me. They applauded. I could feel my hair standing up on end. Why were Jews supporting a massacre? I felt the need to know what this was all about. I began to educate myself about what happened between 1948 and 1982, when I had paid little attention to this part of the world. As I learned and understood more, I became increasingly distraught, then horrified, by the policies and practices of the Israeli government and military toward the Palestinians. So at that point, Hetty became actively involved in the movement for peace in the Middle East, formed the St. Louis chapter of Women in Black, who protested the war, and went eventually to Israel to participate in nonviolent demonstrations there. And I won't read this part, but just for your listening audience, I'm sure that, Cindy, probably nothing can shock you, although it will sadden you, but for people to imagine that the Israeli government keeps track of who's coming over to, you know, cause dissent and trouble, and at airport security, they cavity searched a 70-something-year-old nice. Holocaust survivor. What does that in itself say about what the Israeli government has become?
Right.
In any case, Hetty is careful, I think, in her essay not to make direct comparisons about what she, because she describes her childhood at Nazi Germany and then her experiences with the occupation, and she never does make direct comparisons, but she does write this very moving passage. When I stood for the first time next to the 20-foot-high cement wall in Qalqilia, the motto of Holocaust survivors came unbidden to me, never again. Sadly, I wondered when its meaning had become never again for the Jews, now by them. That is not the lesson of the Holocaust, not for me. To me, never again means never to anyone, and it also means that it is my duty, as long as I am able to do it, to not stand idly by as others suffer.
Wow, that... You know, that's the dichotomy that always bothers me when I think about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, is how can people who suffered so horribly at the hands of others turn around and do the same thing? And how can, you know, the U.S. Support that? But, you know, Ossie, you talk about the myths that you were raised on as a Jewish girl. You know, if you're an American girl, you were raised on a lot of myths, too. And I had to face up to those myths when my son was killed about the United States. So tell us about, I know you have some younger writers in Shifting Sands, and one of them is, a friend of mine, Emma Rosenthal. She has
right.
a pretty good story, too.
She does, and she wrote a prose poem. She actually came to me very late in the process. It was the last piece. I had already submitted the manuscript, and she sent me this poem, and it was like, I didn't know there was a missing piece,
mm-hmm.
but that was it.
It right,
just completed right. the book.
Right.
And she talks in her prose poem about, and I'm trying to find it as I talk, about... her poem is called Good Germans, And mm-hmm. she explains in the beginning that a good German isn't a German. It's someone who sort of pretends they don't know what's going on. That was what the people in Germany were called, who afterwards said, well, we didn't know. We had no idea how bad it was. We just did, you know, and sort of claims ignorance, which is right. sort of the way that things are in Israel. And it's sort of a...
Well, it's the way things are here in the United States,
right.
too.
But it's a sort of there and here and everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, you allow yourself to be blissfully ignorant. The facts are always there, but it's so much easier to not go there and not look at them. And in the poem, she talks about the Jewish girls who were let out of the factory, or they were walking to the factory during the day, let out of the camp, and they would be singing, and the Germans said, well, look, they're singing, everything must be fine, and they stopped right there without thinking, well, they're singing because they're being allowed out of prison for a few hours.
Right.
And what's going on in that prison, or let's engage them. It's sort of like this way of glossing over the unpleasant and deciding that you can just live your life and pretend that you don't know. And I think that another thing she does with her poem, she does make other comparisons to people being good Germans, and she has a line in the poem that says, killing them is killing me, which makes another really important point about the occupation, because the occupation, it drains the morality from the modern state of Israel. It's not just killing the Palestinians, but as my cousin wrote in the essay that I contributed to the book, by occupying these people and doing what we're doing, we're creating a generation of young people who are immune to suffering and see in the Palestinian not a human being but a mass to be avoided and feared. And that's, you know, again, coming back is I think a really important thing that the book does in being very personal, is not allow you to not see the other, because everyone in the story is a human being, and it's very hard to see people as human and then continue to do what you do.
Right.
And my cousin was unable to do that when he had his transformation. You know, he stood up to the Israeli military and refused to do it.
Right on. He was a refusenik?
He was one of the original refuseniks. His name is number 20 on the combatants' letter signatures. And if you'd like me to go there, I can talk about that a little bit, because it was really my point of transformation.
I think you should talk about that, because that's something that is not widespread, you know, known here in the United States, that there are some, because in Israel, whether you're male or female, isn't military service compulsory?
It is compulsory.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and yeah, men, talk about your cousin's experience and your experience.
Okay, well, the military service is compulsory, and men continue to go into the reserves until, I believe, age 40. So with my cousin, here's a boy who, you know, of course, is very close to my heart and was always my favorite cousin, and, you know, kept in touch long distance, but he had been born, he's younger than me, and I remember all this, he had been born with a birth defect that basically makes his right arm useless, and so the Israeli military did not want to put him into combat. And so you have to, you know, kind of put yourself in this totally different headspace to understand that in Israel, that upbringing, that idea of we fight for our country and we're surrounded by enemies and we're this united front, united by this military service, is so strong that this 17-year-old boy fought and fought and fought the bureaucracy to be allowed to be in combat when they didn't want to take him.
Mm-hmm.
So to have that person who I knew had done that turn around and tell me what my military is doing is immoral and I'm not doing it anymore, I knew that that had to be a huge act on his part to make that complete turnaround. And he, when he, so I had to pay attention. At that point, he called and told me, and then he told me, I wrote my commanding officer this, my personal letter, because I feel like it's my responsibility as a soldier. He's a very serious man, and he said, I want you to translate it for me. I want to get it published in the Guardian of London, and my English isn't good enough to do that. And so in reading the combatant's letter, which he had signed, and then reading his own personal letter, which was telling his commanding officer, look, as a soldier, because I'm a soldier, not in spite of being a soldier, I'm under the military code, which says that you have to refuse to follow an illegal command, and our occupation is illegal, and here's why. And at that point, it was really, you know, it forced me to change my outlook. And it also, again, in that thing, I so strongly believe in the power of the personal story. Here's a person that I know and trust and have very high regard for. If he's saying this stuff, then I need to pay attention, right. And I need to rethink my preconceived ideas, and I need to do some research, and I need to figure this out. And, of course, you know, the more that I researched, the more that I looked into things, read on the Internet, read books, talked to people, the more obvious it became that the reality of the situation is very different from what we've all been taught. I eventually decided that, you know, I was so moved by what he had done, because he put his life on the line. Some of the soldiers have been imprisoned for refusing, and, you know, as we've never heard of all this, of course they don't imprison all the soldiers that refuse, because that would have to be a news story. You know, 10,000 Israelis are in prison for refusing to serve in the IDF, right. So they make examples of some, keep people fearful, and he was just sort of, you know, let go from reserve duty and, you know, has moved on with his life and in the peace movement there. But even after everything with him and what I learned, I still, you know, did not come to this book in any kind of radical way. I learned a lot of what I've learned after I began putting the book together. I thought, if he could do what he could do, then here's something I can do from far away. It's my, right. You know, if he can do that, surely I can at least let Israelis know that there's Jewish people in the United States, and let other Jewish people know this is really what's going on. Let me put this book together. But as I read the essays, I was very much educated through the process of reading this book myself. There was a lot I didn't know, and that I've learned through the essays, through talking to the contributors, and through everyone and all the organizations that I've been involved with in that time.
Well, tell my listener, Shifting Sands, what is the meaning behind that title?
Well, it's actually part of a prayer which I had thought was a Jewish prayer, but it's actually, now that I've traced it down to try to find the source, it was a meditation written by a Unitarian minister. I think his name was Robert T. Preston.
Mm-hmm.
Weston. I'll be correct in the book, and it's called Doubt, and it says basically that those who fear doubt, those people who try to silence you, who don't want to hear, who tell you, you know, be quiet, you're being an anti-Semite, don't bring this up. Those who fear doubt, their house is built on shifting sands, but those who fear not doubt and know its value, their house, the house of their spirit is built on a rock. And that makes so much sense to me, because the, you know, truth should become stronger through doubting, not weaker. And if you know that you are speaking the truth, you should not be worried about people questioning it, putting it up to scrutiny, talking about it, and looking at it. Wow. And that's what these ladies do in this book.
Well, absolutely. Well, we only have about a minute left, O.C. This is O.C. Adelfang, the editor of Shifting Sands. Tell my listeners where they can get more information about the book, or maybe how they can order it.
The book is available right now for pre-order through Amazon.com. So they can go directly to Amazon.com, or they can search for Shifting Sands. If you put in Shifting Sands Jewish, you get right to the book, because there's five or six books called Shifting Sands. Or you can go to my website, which is shiftingsands-book.com, and you can click to the Amazon page from there. You can go to the publisher's website at wholeworldpress.org and click to the Amazon site there. And on May 4th, the book will be in print, will be shipped from Amazon, and will also be available in bookstores and libraries and from the publisher.
Well, and then we'll put also a link on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox for this week, so people can probably will link it up to your website. Well, OC, thank you for allowing me to be part of this project, and thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
All right. Thank you so much, Cindy. You're doing wonderful work, and I appreciate you so much.
Okay. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was my guest, O.C. Adelfang. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Thank you for listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, and you, as always, for listening. And I'd like to thank my guest, O.C.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.